Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, fiction writers, memoirists, and poets. I'm Grant Faulkner, and I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, I was quite taken with the novel we're featuring today, What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez by Claire Jimenez. And the premise of the novel is the disappearance of a 13-year-old middle child, Ruthie, who disappeared after track practice without a trace. And then one night, 12 years later, Ruthie's older sister, Jessica, spots a woman on TV in a reality TV show called Catfight. And she rushes to tell her younger sister, Nina, that that woman is Ruthie, because the woman, you know, calls herself Ruthie on the show, and she has a beauty mark under her left eye, just like Ruthie's. And that sets the whole novel in motion. So it's this really interesting premise. And I loved it because it's one of those novels that contains so many things that are both harrowing and hilarious, you know, everything from reality TV to high school drama to sisterly love to intergenerational drama to colonialism, gender, motherhood, faith, and more. That's just so much in this novel. And the one thing that weaves its way through the novel is the subject of grief, which takes different forms in the novel and which has sparked a lot of thoughts about grief and writing about grief for me. And I read that Claire said, grief is one of the hardest emotions to write. And I'd never thought about this, but it struck me as very true. You know, it's similar to writing about love, I suppose, because you risk going over the top, you know, being too sentimental, too emotional. In the end, even though grief and love are high-pitched and overwhelming emotions, they're also subtle and nuanced and mysterious. And I know that grief is obviously a central topic for memoir, Brooke. So I'm curious about your thoughts on the challenges of writing about grief and how do you express grief on the page?
Yeah, you know, it made me think about our very recent interview with Stacey DeRosmo, this idea that intimacy can be many things, and certainly grief and showing readers your grief is a particular kind of intimacy. And just like we were unpacking sentimentality on that show, and you just mentioned sentimentality, which made me think of it, you know, certain emotions like grief, they've just been written so much and so well by so many different writers that I think extra care needs to be taken when writers try to find new ways to write about grief. You know, Terry Gross recently interviewed Salman Rushdie on Fresh Air. I was really taken with the interview, and I think anyone who's writing memoir should hurry to go listen to it. But she said something similar about love, basically that it's hard not to write something cliche these days about love because it's a subject about, you know, which everyone has written in some kind of form. And I just thought that was an astute observation because it doesn't mean we can't or shouldn't tackle explorations of grief or love or other universal emotions, but that we really have to approach it with curiosity and authenticity. So my advice, of course, is don't rush it. You know, in other words, like you don't want your grief to be overly saccharine or to come off sounding terminally unique, which some writers can suffer from, especially newer writers. You want to find windows into a connection with your reader, and that's the intimacy part. And as far as how to do that, I think you write from the heart. You need to explore what grief feels like in your body. You want to play with metaphor and see if you can find ways of showing through imagery what it feels like. I think that's so important, especially in memoir. So it's a tall order, you know, really, but no one said that writing beautiful prose should be easy. And I haven't read this book yet, Grant, but I did read the Times review of Alexandra Fuller's new memoir, which is called Fee, A Memoir of My Son, which is about the loss of her 20-year-old son. And it's been lauded for its exploration and beautiful writing about loss. So I put that out there to say that maybe that's a brand new book about loss and grief that people looking for a good memoir on the topic might check out.
I love this advice, Brooke, especially the idea of writing about how, you know, grief feels in your body, and then approaching it with curiosity and looking at it from different angles, especially through metaphor and imagery. And I was scrolling through Instagram yesterday, and I saw this random quote from Jamaica Kincaid in a meme from the Paris Review. And she said, "I suppose that my work is always mourning something, the loss of a paradise, not the thing that comes after you die, but the thing that you had before." And it reminded me of what Sigrid Nunez said in her, you know, relatively recently published novel, The Vulnerables. "Something is missing. Something has been lost. I believe this is at the heart of why I write." And I've heard it said that every story can be seen as a love story. I'm now thinking that perhaps every story can also be seen as a grief story as well, you know, in the sense that we're never whole. We're always searching for that missing piece and grappling with that sense that we've lost something. And grief has been on my mind, you know, ever since my father died 7 years ago. And you might say I'm kind of been studying grief ever since then, because I'm curious about all of the shapes that it takes. And then the way we talk and observe, or really don't observe, death in our culture, and the way it lives on in a person, you know, kind of with its own mind, you know, its own direction. I'm especially intrigued by how solitary grief can be. You know, Joyce Carol Oates said, "Grief is the most humane of emotions, but it is a one-sided emotion. It is not reciprocated." So to get a little personal, Brooke, I'm curious if you've had any epiphanies or challenges in writing about your father's death.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure this qualifies as an epiphany, and I actually haven't done any explicit writing about my father's death, but something to do with process, actually, or maybe paying attention, because almost since the beginning, you know, right after I lost him, which was just last May, I thought to myself that the only way I was going to experience my dad again would be in my dreams. You know, I know a lot of people who have had dream encounters with loved ones, and I've actually had this experience with the two close friends that I've lost. And it doesn't happen often, but with my dad, I have had it happen 3 times, you know, and it's been quite profound and very visceral, in the sense that I've felt it in my body and I've woken up from the dream, you know, feeling like I've had an encounter of some sort. And the first time and the last time are the most meaningful. So those are the ones that I'll share. You know, the first time I just heard his voice, you know, just calling me honey, which was his primary nickname for me, kind of just like, "I'm here," you know, and I woke up and I had just heard his voice so clearly. And then the second time was much more recent. In the dream, I'm in a store, you know, and every man in there looks like, or has my dad's face actually. But as soon as I touch the man, he looks at me and it's not my dad. And after that happens a few times in the dream, I just ran out of the store and I started wailing. And it was this full body keening, you know, like a kind of crying that I actually have not been able to do in real life, which I found very interesting, because I feel like it's my mind's way of processing grief, you know, this very profound experience of grief. But I will say that, like, how that affects my writing is that it gives me the access to that emotion. And like, even as I'm talking right now, I can feel that sort of upset, you know, sadness in my body. And it's been days since the dream. And so I think we have a lot to take from these liminal spaces. It reminds me so much of our episode with Sivia Gover, which people can go back to, which is about harnessing the power of our dreams and our writing. And so, like I said, I'm not writing about my dad's death, but I am writing about my friend Sarah, and she dies toward the end of my story. And I think that, you know, the emotions I'm accessing with my dad right now will show up on the page somehow in her story, and that I'll be closer to those emotions. You know, and it's not a pleasant feeling, that keening, but I certainly don't wish I hadn't had that dream. You know, I feel grateful for it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's so interesting how dreaming becomes a form for your grief and for a depth of sorrow that perhaps life doesn't truly allow. And mm-hmm. I'm one of those people who doesn't remember most of my dreams, unfortunately. So I'm actually envious. I'd love to wake up with that keening, you know, that depth of feeling, because I feel like life doesn't allow for many things these days. You know, I think we're losing the art of just being sick and resting and taking care of ourselves. And we're losing the art of mourning and taking care of ourselves in a different way. And, you know, I think about the odd phrases that we say to provide comfort after death, you know, things like "time will heal." And I've actually read, you know, about studies that say grief tends to move on after 6 months, which is fine, I suppose. But it's also seems like very capitalistic in the sense of trying to find ways for grief to pass so you can return to being maximally productive, you know, to start seeking fulfillment again. So I think, you know, to shy away from mourning or to try to move on from it is sometimes to do a disservice to its significance, you know, because I think grief is a sacred moment to be honored and sort of linger in. Just on that subject of tending to shy away from talking about death, you know, we do that out of fear because no one wants to say the wrong thing. And I'm as guilty of this as anybody. And it made me think about how Hamlet, who went mad because of his unexpressed grief, you know, his father died and no one wanted him to talk about it. It was driving him crazy. And this is a big purpose of our stories, of course, to allow us to talk about grief, even if just with a book or a movie. And I came across this great essay in Lit Hub recently on grief and writing by Ogni Nuovanelli, who said, "Grief is love, and writing grief in fiction is a work of that love, a vessel for it that is no less vital than anything else in the world." I thought that was so beautiful, you know, how the act of writing is an act of attempted comprehension. You know, we're so baffled and exhausted by what has happened. We want to imagine that giving words to the unspeakable will make it somehow our own, I guess. And I'm sure you deal with a lot, or that you deal a lot with the narrative healing that happens when people write about grief.
Yeah. You know, maybe that's why so many people are drawn to write about their personal experiences of grief in the context of a shorter piece or a longer memoir. It's so true that people are weird about grief, you know, like what you're saying. I think I am guilty of it too. You know, I don't think we can really escape it, you know, and of course I'm sad that my dad died, but sometimes it's hard to talk about losing someone because of other people's reactions to it. And they bring their own stuff, you know, their own feelings and the sort of every once in a while, I feel like pitying feelings or, you know, the I'm so sorry feelings. And that's appropriate, but it's hard because we don't have a good language for it. And, you know, sometimes I wish people would just say something like, "What do you miss most about him?" Or, you know, even what was his name? You know, if that were a natural thing to say. But we all engage in these platitudes. And as you said, rightly, Grant, you know, we don't know what to say. And that really does lead into what you're talking about. You know, we don't have good language. We don't even have good rituals per se outside of memorial services. So it just makes sense to me that people turn to the page to articulate this profound thing that really wants to get processed. And many writers I work with carry profound grief with them, you know, maybe for their entire lives. So this idea that, well, and grief is not one thing. That's the other thing, right? I mean, it's not just the loss of someone. I mean, grief can be grieving how you grew up because you had abandonment or, you know, trauma or abuse. And memoir is an important outlet for that. And I do want to state that there's a difference between journaling and memoir writing, which people know, of course. But sometimes that early purging or making sense of things really does need to happen in the journaling process. And then you can start to separate out the threads that are universal and not cliche, as Terry Gross said, you know, and then you delve into the writing that is for your readers. So Grant, I'm wondering what you think about all this. You know, have you given thought to the why part, you know, about writing about grief, and what's been your own experience of writing about grief?
Yeah, well, first, I love your advice to come up with a better language around grief, you know, like, because saying I'm sorry or thoughts and prayers just feels so insignificant. And so I love the idea of pausing and asking for a story or a simple, what do you miss about him or her? I think that's a wonderful way to open up a conversation. And my own experience about writing about grief is centered on this yearning for stories, you know, both to preserve the person and those memories, but also to create them. You know, our memories aren't static things. They move around. So I think writing about grief isn't just an act of recording, but a vital act of creation. And with my father, I've even gone back and bought books about the period of time that he grew up on this farm in Iowa, you know, just to read about others' memories. And it's almost like that reading blends into my memories of him and kind of creates a new story. Hmm. But I do think that, you know, obviously we're meaning-making creatures, and the need to acquire meaning, you know, is just intrinsic to us, even when, you know, that meaning lives only inside our minds, you know, which is why reading and writing about grief is just so important. And healing, although I don't know that healing is quite the right word. I think it's just kind of like an ongoing exploration. I want to mention this quote before we move on to our interview with Claire. Elizabeth Gilbert, she wrote about her thoughts after the death of her partner, Raya Elias, and I thought they were really beautiful. She wrote this in The Marginalian. She wrote, "Grief happens upon you. It's bigger than you. There's a humility that you have to step into where you surrender to being moved through the landscape of grief by grief itself. And it will be done with you eventually. And when it is done, it will leave. But to stiffen, to resist, and to fight, it is to hurt yourself." And so I think that's just great advice, you know, to not put a timetable on it, to go with it and not resist it. And so I'm really interested in talking to Claire Jimenez, who captures so many sides of grief and loss and what happened to Ruthie Ramirez. So it's going to be interesting to hear what she says after this short break. Welcome back, everybody. I am thrilled to introduce Claire Jimenez, who is a Puerto Rican writer who grew up in Brooklyn and Staten Island, New York. Claire is the author of the short story collection Staten Island Stories and What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez. She received her MFA from Vanderbilt University and her PhD in English with specializations in ethnic studies and digital humanities from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And in 2019, she co-founded the Puerto Rican Literature Project, a digital archive documenting the lives and work of hundreds of Puerto Rican writers from over the last century. Currently, she is an assistant professor of English and African American Studies at the University of South Carolina. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you because I loved your novel. And I read that this novel actually started as a short story and then grew into a novel, and that the novel actually took 10 years to write. And I have also spent 10 years on a novel. And so I was wondering if, as a way to introduce the novel to our listeners, I was wondering if you could tell us about the growth of the novel from a short story and what sparked the idea for it.
So the story actually started when I was at Vanderbilt completing my MFA, and it was kind of a weird short fat story. It was like 30 pages or so. Basically, I'd begun writing it with that prologue, actually, which in the story was kind of tucked in the middle. And later on, we moved it to the beginning of the novel. But I had started with this disappearance of this 13-year-old girl in the 90s in Staten Island. And later on, as I was writing it and kind of stuck, I was watching reality TV. I was watching, I think it was like the Jersey Shore or something. And I remember seeing somebody on this TV show and thinking, oh my God, is this so-and-so from high school, and like trying to figure it out. And so it was kind of serendipity. This made me think, you know, what would happen if a family who had lost somebody they loved was watching TV and saw somebody on TV that looked remarkably like them? You know, what would happen next? And that gave the story an engine, and you know, it grew from there. But it was a pretty long story. It's like 30 pages or so. And I graduated and had trouble placing it. I went back to New York, where I'm from, and adjuncted for a while and worked at like an arts council. And then eventually I kind of tapped out of that work because, as you know, as you can imagine, adjuncting in New York City, eventually you start to get little notices about late rent. So I was like, I need to write. How can I write and have that time and get a little bit of money? And so I went and enrolled in a PhD program in University of Nebraska, where they provided you a stipend and you went to workshops. And I remember bringing this story to workshop. And one of the professors there was like, you know, Claire, one of the issues with this story is that it's actually a novel. And she was like, I need you to just, you know, she was one of these professors who was always like, you know, give me 80 pages, give me lots of chapters. He pushed everybody in workshop to just write, you know, to get to the end and not be kind of precious about rewriting things over and over again. And that's how it became what it is now. It went through several revisions because originally I'd written it as a novel going backwards in time, because I was interested in this idea, that backward motion as sort of echoing the movement of trauma, how you keep on going back in time. But something was happening where it didn't quite have enough momentum. And so I talked with some professors. I met with one of them, Timothy Shafford, who said, you know, Claire, why don't you just try writing it straight? You know, because you have the rotating perspective. So it would be easier maybe if you had this kind of traditional form, like this journey narrative, right, that you can hang these multiple perspectives on. And so that helped. But it took a while.
Yeah. Well, 10 years. Yeah. But that, it's great. It's one of those stories that we love to hear for the perseverance part. So it's a novel of many emotions, Claire, but grief is one of the most important ones. And you've said grief is one of the hardest emotions to write. And so I was wondering if you could tell us more about that. Why do you think grief is so hard to write? You know, in your experience, what was hard about it? And maybe you can shine some light onto that for our listeners.
Yeah, I think it's sort of for the person grieving, you know, there's that absence of language to really describe what you're feeling. And there's also this absence of language for the people around them to comfort them, right? It's sort of like, it's like that weird movie Midsommar where like the women are just all, you know, circled around each other and just start wailing. I don't know if you've watched that movie before, that scene, but I often think about that. I'm like, oh, it's where language collapses. And so, I, in writing the novel, I really wanted to think about absence and grief and how people talk about, you know, the things that have happened to them. And for this particular family, or, you know, specifically somebody like Nina, who's one of the narrators, the way that she copes with things, you know, is humor, sarcasm, you know, all of this. And so that's one way of dealing with loss and hard, difficult moments. And I also wanted to portray these narrators that are kind of circling around that absence. That's why I have them kind of rotating and thinking about like what one knows that the other doesn't, and putting that all together through this novel, this multi-perspective novel.
Well, Claire, another emotion you touch on, or more than touch on in the novel, is a mother's guilt, you know, and I think of guilt being, as a parent, I say this, I think of it as an inherent part of the general parenting experience, but
yeah.
but for Dolores, I think it's even more so, obviously, because yeah. She's got this deep-seated guilt about Ruthie's disappearance, which makes the ways in which she has, you know, raised her even more kind of guilt-producing. And I'm curious about the role of guilt in the novel, especially since Dolores' voice is rendered through prayer.
Mm-hmm. So with her perspective, really, I was thinking about, I mean, there's this one moment in the novel where she says, how can I wake up, you know, and go throughout my day or smile knowing that my daughter could be hurt somewhere or need me, you know? And I was really interested in that question. How do you survive that type of loss of your child? And it kind of, it's interesting because when I began writing the novel, I didn't have a child, and, you know, and then I had one and I was just like, oh Lord, you know, how do you get through that? Hmm. And the only way that Dolores's sections made sense to me was sort of as this profane prayer, and this, constant conversation with God about trying to make sense of this loss. And so that's why I very intentionally like format her sections in this conversation with God and faith.
You know, I really love that part so much, just in terms of experimenting with form. And, you know, as harrowing as the novel is, and certainly its premise, it's also hilarious, you know, and humor can, of course, carry books that have a lot of trauma and sadness in them. And tragicomedy has been a thing since forever. But could you speak to the intermingling of humor and grief and how you managed to balance the two?
It's interesting because I wrote this story not with thinking like, oh, I'm going to also incorporate humor. It was just how I knew how to tell the story, mostly because growing up, that was natural for a lot of the people I know, that humor often came when challenging situations. And it's interesting. I was listening to the interview you did with Javier Zamora about how, and you were talking about writing trauma and how there also has, you know, looking for places of relief in the narrative. And I think that's true in real life, that you need that in order to get through. And so I had set out to write a humorous take on, you know, a disappeared daughter. However, that was just part of, you know, the narration and part of how I thought about telling this story.
Hmm. Well, the three sisters are in some ways at the heart of the novel. And I've heard you say that silence shapes voice. And I thought that was such an interesting way to think about voice as a writer and just in life in general. So I was wondering if you could talk about that in general and then how it applies to the sisters' voices.
Yeah, I actually did a whole lecture on voice just last week. I'm so fascinated. I mean, I always begin thinking about voice. People are like, do you have a plot idea? You know, do you outline? And for me, it's, oh, I'm really obsessed with the way people speak. And I've always been like that. And so I start with how things sound and then I go from there. And in terms of voice, I'm thinking about, you know, what are characters always saying, right? But I'm also thinking about what do they never say? And what do they say instead, right? And so, which is basically subtext. And so I think about this in terms of what are the silences that these women carry? And why is it that they can't say these things? But also it could be, you know, my dad is the type of person who doesn't say, I'm sorry. Instead, he says, I got you pizza, come down, you know? Like, and so I think that that tension is something that I'm very interested in all of my work, not only this novel.
Well, Claire, I appreciate you having brought up Javier and his interview because I wanted to ask you about trauma. You know, and trauma is rarely individual. You know, it oftentimes is inherited or cultural or global. And your novel is about the inherited trauma of U.S. Puerto Rico colonialism. And it shows how the impact of that history is privately experienced. So it's both. It's individual and cultural and global. So three ways. So how does a historical fact like that, you know, manifest itself into your narrative? I wonder if you could speak to that more broadly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this goes back to the silences that are carried, right? And so we see this especially with Dolores, whose history, whose childhood is marked by this circular migration between Puerto Rico, New York, the Bronx, and she ends up in Brooklyn, and then she ends up in Staten Island, right? And I'm really interested in how the violence of displacement, right? And not just like that as an abstraction, because I think, you know, sometimes we get into these bigger conversations. We're like, the violence of poverty, the violence of displacement, the, you know, U.S. colonization, right? But I want to see how that plays out in very concrete ways in this family, in the intergenerational tensions between the mother who actually grew up in Puerto Rico as opposed to the daughters who are of the diaspora, and how that manifests itself and what they feel they can say or cannot say, or what they can understand or cannot understand. The mother, the way the mother parents her children with like an iron fist is directly a product of, you know, this the violence of this migration and feeling like she needs to protect her daughters, right? And so I was really trying to put into detail this experience that I think sometimes is very intellectualized, so that not only for other people to understand, but for also for myself.
Well, Claire, in closing, I was wondering if we could shift away from your novel, I guess, but if you could tell us more about your work on the digital archive, the Puerto Rican Literature Project, you know, where you're documenting the work of Puerto Rican writers since the Jones Act.
Yeah, the Puerto Rican Literature Project is a digital archive. It's funded through the Mellon Foundation. We were very lucky. I work with a group of scholars from Puerto Rico and the diaspora and the University of Houston, USLDH, Arte Público Press, that team. And we have been working on digitizing really hundreds of poets over the last 3 years, documenting their work and digitizing sample poems so that it can become more available to everybody, because the truth is that so much of our literature is out of print, is not written about enough. It's a bilingual portal, which is really exciting for us, so that it can reach cross language, especially to Puerto Ricans, both in the archipelago and in the diaspora. And another thing I'm working on is this digital map tracing the publications of Puerto Ricans in the diaspora and in the archipelago across the last century, across time and space. Yeah, so it's a monster of a project that requires lots of people. We have a team of translators. We have a team, you know, we have people who work in DH. We have somebody who's, you know, making the site. And then we, a lot of us are doing interviews with the poets, and we're hoping that the phase two, we can move into fiction.
Awesome.
Yeah. So it's exciting work.
Thank you so much, Claire. Really appreciated your interview.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. So
Well, thanks, Clara. Thanks for the writing and the work in the broader world. I'm really happy to have you on.
Thank you, Brooke.
We'll be right back after this short break with today's book trend.
Today's trend is really about the intersection of publishing and politics, which is a common point of intersection historically. And we're in a very challenging moment culturally, maybe more accurately defined as a challenging era in this country and in our world. And this is more of a news story than a trend, Brooke. I'm talking about The Guardian's coverage of this report that 31 authors and translators have withdrawn their work from consideration for, or they've declined, PEN America's 2024 Literary Awards over the organization's failure to protect, that's in quotes from them, Palestinian writers in Gaza. This is a pretty big blow to PEN and shows how staying silent in this challenging moment has its own consequences.
Oh my gosh, don't I know it. Even as a publisher, I felt so conflicted about how to talk about my feelings about what's happening in the Middle East ever since October. And Grant, you know, this finally came to a head for me about a month ago. And I decided, you know, just after seeing on both sides, frankly, everyone talking about silence and, you know, how problematic it all is, to post an open letter to my Jewish authors as a way to articulate how I'm feeling. I mean, I guess you could say my stance. And I wrote about my both and perspective. It's such a polarizing topic and really scary to wade into. I mean, I was terrified actually to post that letter. The book industry is so Jewish and, you know, it's been particularly hard to know even how to have these conversations, what to say. But the fallout has been that in not talking about it, everyone is pissed off. And so we do need to learn to have better ways to have these conversations. And PEN to me feels well positioned to do that. So I think they're kind of pushing back is, you know, it's certainly not working well for them.
Mm-hmm. It can be so difficult to know what to say. And I also think that we're past the point where nothing, where silence is okay, because it suggests, as the writer said in the open letter, complicity. And again, according to The Guardian, the letter highlights the stark contrast again, in quotes, between the stance of PEN America and those of other PEN centers around the world. You know, it read in part, English PEN in tandem with Irish PEN and Wales PEN Simroom have been vocally critical of the UK government's uncritical support for Israel, have called for investigations into the sale of arms to Israel, and have demanded political pressure for Israel to comply with international law. PEN America, by contrast, has had no criticism of American complicity in the bombardment of Gaza.
Thanks for reading that. And as part of what we're wanting to share with people, I mean, we do know that the personal is political. And like I said, I think because publishing in other media has such deep Jewish roots, and because there has been this truly unfortunate conflation happening where any criticism of Israel is seen as anti-Semitic, that a lot of organizations have just gotten themselves tied up in knots. And then the best way forward, or so they think, is to do and say nothing. I can't advise any given organization, of course, on what their response should be. But I will say that for me, my open letter was met with resounding support by my Jewish authors and many other self-identified Jews who posted their comments and appreciation. And so my feeling is that we're all a lot closer on these issues than it may appear. And what drives the silence is fear of alienating people, really. I mean, that's why I didn't say anything for so long. I was so scared of alienating my Jewish community. But, you know, as I can attest to as a teacher of memoir, that silence, it eats at you. You know, silence leaves too much room for interpretation. And so it does look like the consequences of their silence for PEN is just going to be a pretty big shakeup of their executive leadership.
Yeah, the writers are calling for the resignation of PEN's CEO, Suzanne Nossel, the president, Jennifer Finney Boylan, and the entire executive committee. And the Guardian piece is definitely worth reading because it also shares PEN's response. And just to represent them, PEN said, "The current war in Gaza is horrific, but we cannot agree that the answer is to its wrenching dilemmas and consequences lies in less discourse, less honoring of writers, and less shining a light on the critical contributions of writers." And this is, you know, an interesting response because it misses the point a little bit. I think it seems pretty clear that the writers of this letter are not suggesting that there be less honoring of writers, just more of a proactive conversation, I think.
Right. And I don't even think that they're necessarily needing them to take the same stance as Penn UK and Penn Ireland, but rather that they not shy away from the discourse that people are saying that they need to engage in. So I wish all of them luck. It's not an easy position to be in. And, you know, Grant, I'm happy for our trend section because it allows us the space to sometimes go to the heart of difficult things. Book publishing is a microcosm of the wider culture because books are such a staple in our lives and, you know, they impact how we think, they inform what we know. And for my part, I hope that any listener who's interested will check out my open letter to Jewish authors on my Substack. You know, we do have to give voice to things, and this is what authors are charged to do, in fact, right? We, as writers, need to not be silent. We need to raise our voices, not just on geopolitical topics, by the way, right? But on whatever your heart feels called to say. So we appreciate you all so much. You're part of our community. Raise your voices loud. You are our reason for being here every week, and we will see you next time.